Be with you always. I missed being here last Sunday. I was not feeling well. I was not feeling well when I started on my trip to get Timothy. But I appreciate all your prayers and well wishes that helped me get through both of those endeavors. And I keep thinking I've got this cold about licked, and then it seems like it rears its ugly head again. And I was thinking, if my voice doesn't give out, or if it doesn't hold up, we may very well be softly and tenderly calling for you at the invitation song, because that's all I'll have left. But I have been feeling pretty well. So good to have so many here, and it's a season of families being reunited, and we're enjoying that, and I see many others are as well, and I hope that all goes well for you. So glad, though, that you make time to be here and to give attention to spiritual things, as I know is your habit for so many of you, and I appreciate that so much. I'm often set in remembrance of Jesus saying in one scenario, "Remember Lot's wife." There is a point to be made from that whole scenario, abbreviated by just calling the character to remembrance. Remember Lot's wife. Jesus in that moment did not have the time, it seems, certainly did not take the time to go back and to teach that entire lesson and to make that application. He simply, by mentioning that character, Lot's wife, called that whole scenario and application to the mind of the hearers. If, and this is a big if they had studied that, if they knew that. And I think inherent in Jesus' statement there is the idea that he ought to be able to do that with us, that he ought to be able to just say, remember that Old Testament story and make the application, and we should know that. And it's that idea that is behind the study that I do, the study that you do, I imagine, so that you can understand those things in the Old Testament and rightfully apply them as the need comes around. At least I hope that is the way that you see that. I wonder if I mentioned to you, remember the book of Job, how many would be able to just say, all right, and play out the entire scenario of the book of Job and be able to make an application from it. The book of Job is a wonderful study. I was there was a reason for me earlier this year to go through the entire book with someone, which I did, which I enjoyed very much, and so did the person that I was studying with. Often when we get done with a study like that, people will say, and I've done it several times in my life, get done with that, and they say, you know, that's an amazing book, and I didn't realize it was so easy to understand, and I didn't realize it meant it was so significant. And so I'm always eager to be able to lead people to a study of the book of Job, and I hope you can just play it out in your mind. Now, if you can't, and I'm kind of assuming that you can't right off, I'm going to go through it with you just very quickly this evening and make a different kind of an application. Normally when we study the book of Job, there's a point to be made or an application to be made concerning an issue like patience and the need for patience, or maybe even dealing with the idea of human suffering, as it was recently phrased in a book title, Why Bad Things Happen to Good People. The book of Job has much to say about patience and the problem of human suffering. But there's another application that I'd like to make, and one that I think is very much warranted by the book, one that we don't see too often. The book of Job, we understand, is one of the oldest of books, but it doesn't claim to fit in with any of the Bible history in the sense that you don't need to fit it in a key place for it to make sense, and the rest of the story of the Bible flows just fine without it. It's an isolated incident in the life of an individual character, and it pretty much stands and falls on its own. I mean, it stands on its own, and it has an application that is independent of chronology. It just can be considered in and of itself and have the point, and make the point that it needs to make. It's an eternal lesson for us. It's an important lesson, or lessons in that book. And I want to just real quickly go through the whole book with you. Now, the way I have this set up is it's probably better if you don't look at your book. If you try to follow along with your Bible right now, you will be frustrated. You will think that I'm going way too fast. If you just watch the screens and listen to the narration, it should be pretty easy to follow. So try it that way. The introduction to the book presents the man Job, and then gives with that introduction of that man a number of characteristics that I hope the Lord could be able to say of me. And I hope that he'd be able to say of almost any of us, certainly the men that are here. He's blameless, he's upright, he fears God, he avoids evil. He was a father, and he was rich. He had lots of possessions, he had a large family. It was a wonderful summary. And if any of us could be so summarized by God, that would be a wonderful thing. But after that, very quickly, there's a meeting that takes place. And in that meeting, we see that God is present, and Satan shows up from walking on upon the earth. And as they're all there, God draws Satan's attention to Job. Have you considered Job? And in that question is a restatement of Job's character and the good things about him. And this statement sets up the whole rest of the book. It's going to be repeated, but here, there's something about this man, Job, and there's something about Satan where there could be a prophet from Satan considering Job. And God just asks the question, have you considered this man? Well, Satan says, yeah, I've considered him, and I know he's doing well, I know he follows you, but he's surely just following you because you've given him so much stuff. He's got a big family, he's got possessions, and if you give people a big family, you give them a lot of possessions, sure, they'll be nice to you. And basically, God says, or Satan says to God, that's why Job is obedient to you. Well, in order to prove a point, then God gives permission. God allows Satan. He does not command him to do this. He allows Satan to do this. He allows him to destroy those things of Job's with the restriction that he cannot, at this time, harm Job personally, individually, in any way. You can't touch his person, but you can touch his possessions. And so what happens then is in this first affliction recorded in the latter part of chapter 1, there is destruction upon Job from every quarter. And in these briefest of scenarios, destruction comes upon him and leaves him then with his children dead and his riches gone, his property destroyed or scattered. And there's one who said, fairly humorously, I guess, or the intent was humorously, poor Job in this scenario, he lost his children and his stuff and he kept his wife, because his wife wasn't a particular asset at this point. She says, why don't you just curse God and die? But in all of this, Job does not sin, and he does not charge God with any blame at this point. Well, at the end of this, then, there's another meeting, and God is there, and Satan is there, and God says again, have you considered Job, a man who is upright and blameless and avoids evil? He's still upright, even though you've taken all his stuff. You said it was just about stuff, and that's why he was following me. His stuff's gone, and he still follows me. And Satan, in kind, answers with slander again, and says, yeah, a man will give everything so that he can keep his health. It's because he's healthy that he still serves you. And so, with this accusation filed against Job, God now allows Satan to harm him with the restriction, still a restriction, that he will not kill him. He cannot kill him. God did not command him to harm him. He allowed him to harm Job. And so with this, a second affliction comes upon him, and we see Job afflicted with boils from head to toe. And the misery in which he finds himself is complete and overwhelming. He's lost everything in the previous affliction. Now he's lost his health. And of course, with losing your health in this magnitude is a loss of dignity. And we find him on an ash heap, scraping himself with a broken piece of pottery in agony. Terrible situation has fallen upon him. But still, in all this, Job does not charge God and does not sin with his lips. And that's amazing. All of this in consideration of Job's character and is trying to prove a point to Satan. What happens now is Job's friends arrive. Now, they say they're his friends. And as they assemble, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, they for 7 days do nothing more than weep and mourn with him and are there with him. Later, he would say to them, in their statements that they make, that they were miserable comforters. And this is actually the best comfort that they afforded when they were just there and quiet with him and suffering with him without saying anything. Terrible situation in which we find him. And in chapter 3, it's Job's lament. And he just is so, he addresses God and says, it would have been better if I had never been born or if I were stillborn. But he has a bitter life, and he's completely overwhelmed and sorry about the situation in which he's fallen. Well, now, next few chapters, chapters 4 through 14, are exchanges, a series of exchanges, in order, in succession, between these friends and Job. First it is Eliphaz, who says, Job, you must have sinned for all this stuff to happen to you. You've got to have sinned. But Job denies that and says, no, I don't believe I have. Don't believe that I have. Next, it's Bildad who says in chapter 8, no, you, Job, you've got to have sinned for all this to happen to you. You must have sinned. And he says, no, I don't believe that I have. I'm making long stories short here to get through this quickly. And finally, Zophar, the one who is the most direct, who has the least tact of any of them, probably the oldest, I think, probably the angriest, he says to them, definitely you've sinned. He's more blunt than the rest. And Job, again, just denies it and goes on and says, I do not believe that I have. Now, of course, he was already pronounced blameless and upright at the very start of this, but that's unknown to the friends and unknown to Job. And they're all trying to reason this out together, and they're not agreeing much. Finally, in chapter 14, Job finishes up with another complaint to God. And basically he says, God, you're punishing me as if I were a sinner, and you must have made some mistake, because everybody knows only sinners get punished like this. And check the books. I'm not really a sinner, and please remove this punishment. It's not due me. Well, the second round, and to go very quickly, chapters 15 through 21, a similar exchange. But they're getting each a little more pointed. How can you say you haven't sinned? How can anybody say that they haven't sinned? And this is when Job starts to rebuke his friends and say, you're not doing, if you're here to cheer me up, you're not. It's not working, okay? Bildad says, look, the wicked are punished. Everybody knows the wicked are punished. You're getting punished, so what do you think? You must be wicked. And he says, no, I'm not wicked. I'm sure I'm not wicked. And then the tactless Zophar says, you're a wicked man. And Job says, no, I'm not. No, I'm not. I'm really not. And he finishes up. The third round, chapters 22 through 28, Eliphaz says, you are wicked. You are wicked. And Job answers, no, God has made a mistake. God punishes wicked people. He's punishing me. I'm not wicked. He must have made some sort of mistake. The next round, Bildad says, no man can say that he's righteous. No man can say that he is without sin and not wicked. But Job says, well, I'm not wicked. And Zophar, this round, just had enough of him. He doesn't even speak up in the third round. He said it all before. He doesn't speak up again. Job has summary comments in chapters 28 through 31, and it looks like maybe that's going to be the end of it until, and again, he's accusing God of making a mistake. But then we see another opinion. We see that it seems that there's been this other fellow, a younger fellow, Elihu, who's been listening to this exchange, or all these exchanges, and he doesn't think that anybody's got it summarized real well, and he thinks he can do better. So he says, and very tactfully, he says, I think you've all got it wrong, and let me try to explain the situation as well. And he tries to summarize things in a diplomatic kind of way in chapters 32 through 37. Well, finally, Job has been petitioning God right along, telling me he's made a mistake, wondering what's going on, asking God to intercede and straighten things out. And finally, God shows up on the scene, or reveals himself to Job. And in chapter 38 and verses, and chapters 39 as well, God starts to speak. And right away, I'm sure Job just wishes he hadn't phrased things exactly the way he did. Because the Lord begins with him. First of all, it says that God spoke to him out of the whirlwind. Now, we'd call that a tornado. And, you know, tornadoes aren't particularly nice to see coming your ways, especially when it's from the Lord. The Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind. Often when I'm speaking on this, I like to slap something when I say whirlwind, but I know we've got a few people on pacemakers around here, so I'm not going to do that. But, you know, this is a violent thing that the Lord's doing here, answering him out of the whirlwind. And he says, now I don't want to make this sound very nice, who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? You know, the more you talk, the less impressed I am with you, Job. You know, I mean, you don't have any idea what's going on. This is basically what the Lord is saying to him. You don't know what you're talking about. Now prepare yourself like a man. I will question you and you'll answer me. That's how God starts with him. And then he starts to ask all these questions. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? And I can just imagine being poor Job. I mean, he's got enough troubles. But now he's trying to listen to the Lord, rebuke him, and ask him to give answers to these things, of course, which he cannot answer. Well, it goes on in chapter 38 and 39, just this way. God never does let him ask the question. Ask the question he wanted to ask. God asks him the question, and he has no answers for him. So Job speaks and says, look, I'm sorry. I'm not going to say anything more. God answers him again, and this time he just hammers him. And he says, no, I'm not done with you yet. He says, prepare yourself like a man, and I'll question you, and you shall answer me. Would you indeed annul my judgment? You think you're smarter than me? You think you know more? And he goes on, and he says, let me ask you some more questions, see if you can answer these. Of course, he couldn't answer any of them. And finally, Job just says, I'm really sorry. I know that you can do everything, that no purpose of yours can be withheld from you. You asked, who is this who hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore, I've uttered what I did not understand. I spoke out of turn. I was out of line, Job says. Things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. Listen, please, let me speak. You said, I will question you. You shall answer me. I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Therefore, I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes. Job withdraws all his statements to God about God making a mistake, withdraws all of his questions to God that he had posed, and he says he's sorry. At this point, God rebukes everybody else in the scenario. He says, you need to apologize to Job. You need to see if he'll pray for you that you might be forgiven, because in fact they were miserable comforters and they weren't much help at all. And in the epilogue, in the closing of the book, we see the same pronouncements that we saw initially about Job repronounced for him. And we see that he's wound up in the same state actually a better state with more wealth and more family in the end than in the beginning. And it looks like a happy ending. It sure does. It looks pretty good at the end. There's a few summary comments on the book of Job. Job's suffering was not punishment. He was not being punished for anything he'd done wrong. His friends assumed that it was. He assumed that it was. Everyone was operating with the assumption that wicked men are punished, and they went the other way, saying, if you're getting punished, if you're getting afflicted like this, it's punishment for something. We know, having the benefit of the context in which this was all set up, having seen what went on in the meetings between God and Satan, that there was nothing in here about Job's punishment. And it ought to teach us that there can be affliction separate and apart, nothing to do with punishment. Sometimes bad things do happen to good people, and it's not about them getting punished for something that they did. God in this never afflicted Job. He allowed him to be afflicted, but it was always Satan that was doing the afflicting. God did not afflict. Job never gets told why all this came about. He never does get to ask his questions or to have his questions answered by God. God never volunteers that there was this meeting initially and that Job was set up as an example so that a lesson might be taught to someone else. That never is revealed to Job. And it makes me think that there are lots of times the saints go through suffering as well, and they never do find out why there'd be, why all that would come upon them. Job never found out. We may never find out either. Notice that the latter blessings that Job enjoyed exceeded the first, and that having endured the suffering, he was blessed by God. It seems to me his suffering improved him. It seemed he was better off, better adjusted afterward than before. Understood things a little bit better. And I know that from his suffering others benefit because I've benefited. And I imagine everybody that studies this book benefits in some way from this understanding of how the world works and how suffering comes upon people. But the thing that really gets me, and the application I want to make tonight about this book is, what about Satan? Satan initially arrives on the scene, and God says, have you considered Job? And he says, yeah, I figured him all out. He's in it for the stuff. God allows him to take the stuff away, and then says, again, after he's found faithful, have you considered my servant Job? And he says, yeah, it's all about health. So he lets him take his health away, and he still stays faithful. But we never get to press up, or God, it does not press and follow through in any way that we can see here with Satan to make him understand that this obedience that Job was bringing forth didn't have anything to do with stuff, didn't have anything to do with health. It was independent of all those things. And you'd think that maybe Satan would understand at the end what true obedience was like and where it comes from. But we don't get that opportunity, or we don't see that God had that opportunity. Satan just went on. There's no closure in this. Satan never does apologize to anybody here. He doesn't have any valid explanation. By the way everything played out in the book, you can tell that the initial explanations that Satan gives for Job's good behavior are invalid. They do not work. They are not justified. And he doesn't offer any other explanation either for why this good man does these good things. And it seems to me that Satan never will be able to understand and never will be able to explain good people like Job. And that he probably is just going to go on lying and afflicting and slandering and doing all the things that he does. Seems to me that Satan doesn't learn a thing. There are a lot of things Satan can't explain. This whole scenario that sets this up. God asks, have you considered this righteous man? This perfect man, this upright man, this man that fears God, this one that avoids evil. I wonder if you've considered not only Job, but people like Job. Have you considered other folks around you? There are lots of things Satan can't explain, lots of things that he should consider, lots of things we should consider. What do you think about people who take of their hard-earned money and give to hurricane victims in foreign countries, poor countries? What do you think about that? Absolutely no expectation of return from that. Those poor folks are never going to be able to help them in any way. What do you think about people who do that? Do you have an explanation for that? What do you think about young men who refuse to walk with their friends when the friends take advantage of young women, have sexual relations outside of marriage, and the young men refrain from that? What do you think about young men like that? What do you think about young men who refuse to remain idle, who work and help, who redeem their time, who care for their parents, who care for the infirm, who look in on others who can't take care of themselves completely? How do you explain that? We do well to consider that. What do you think about young women who refuse to gossip, who refuse to go with their friends to things that are unholy and unseemly, but busy themselves at their work, either in the home or outside of the home? How do you explain young women like that? How do you explain mothers? Mothers who labor from early morning until late at night, caring for their families, physical, social, mental, and spiritual needs, every need being addressed by the mother. What do you think about that? How do you explain women who do that? What do you think about grandmothers who've raised their own children and then take on the responsibility of raising their children's children? How do you explain that? What do you think about Bible class teachers whose children are grown or they have no children of their own and they spend their time regularly teaching your children, giving of their precious time to teach others, the next generation? How do you explain that? What do you think about deacons, young men with families, or men with young families who give of their spare time to serve others, often in ways that don't get noticed much and don't get mentioned much? How do you explain men who do that? How do you explain elders, men with families of their own, who take of their spare time, if there is such a thing, and watch for the souls of others, diligent in prayer, in teaching, in rebuking other people? How do you explain that? What do you think about could-be athletes? And when I say could-be athletes, I mean people who have the ability to perform, have that athletic talent, and they have a great sense of accomplishment when they play and when they win and when they show their prowess, but refuse to participate in certain things because of modesty issues. And the world may never know how good they are because they just figure, I'm not going to do that in public. How do you explain that? How do you explain older men who've been successful in their business careers and in all their works? They've done their businesses uprightly. The Lord has blessed them with that. And then they turn around and are very generous with their time and with their money, helping others around them. How do you explain that when there's so many other things you could do with your money and your time that they spend it helping others, giving with no expectation of return? I was thinking as I was studying this that Satan is at a loss to explain any of those things. He has nothing to say, nothing that's right, nothing that's valid, no explanation for that. And I was thinking it was Satan's problem, but then I got thinking, you know, I can't explain it either. I really can't explain why people do things like that. But I consider it, and I think that's all the Lord was saying. Have you considered people like that? And if you have people like that in your life, you'd do well to consider them and to appreciate them
and to realize how much you've been blessed by people like that. There are a lot of them around here. Well, I guess I got through it. Still have my voice. Who here is subject to the gospel call? Who needs to come to the Lord for the first time or the umpteenth time? We do not count around here. However many times you need to come back, that's however many times you ought to. And if you haven't come to the Lord first time yet, you ought to at least do that one. If you're subject to the call and if we can help you in any way, won't you come while we stand, while we sing?